Hey, it's Motley Fool Money co-host Dylan Lewis here. If you're listening to us, it's because you love following the stock market and learning about business stories. If you're looking to keep learning and unlock your potential, then you should check out the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast produced by our friends over at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the Webby Award-winning Best Business Podcast that's received nearly 43 million downloads and is the number one career podcast in 95-plus countries, so you know it's worth your time. Each week, host and Stanford lecturer Matt Abraham sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to hone and develop your communication skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, to keeping your nerves in check while speaking, to being more persuasive. Whether you're working on your elevator pitch or planning an important meeting, strong communication skills are important in business and life in general. That's why you'll hear from pros like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, as well as speechwriter, best-selling author, and friend of the Fool Dan Pink on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more available on the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast. So what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
Everybody needs money. That's why they call it money.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees.
From Fool Global Headquarters, this is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money. Thanks for being here. I'm your host, Chris Hill, and I'm joined by Motley Fool Senior Analyst Seth Jason, James Early, and Ron Gross. Guys, good to see you.
Good to see you, Chris.
How are you?
Coming up, we'll give you the latest on Microsoft, Apple, and Fisher-Price's recall of more than 10 million toys. We'll talk with Academy Award-nominated filmmaker Charles Ferguson about his new documentary about the financial crisis. Plus, as always, an inside look at the stocks on our radar. But we begin with the big macro. Guys, some of the stories making news this week. The stock market was up nearly 9% in September, making it the best September since 1939. Consumer spending in August was up slightly, and U.S. consumer confidence improved slightly in the latest ABC News survey. Seth Jason, we'll start with you. What was your headline of the week?
Wow, 1939. I don't need to keep an eye on Germany, do I?
No.
Bring back memories.
Excellent. That's really good news, 10%. My headline, I guess that consumer confidence number, the consumer spending number, well, wasn't so bad, but none of this is really up to a level of what we would expect coming out of a big recession, which according to the guys with the green eye shades, the statisticians, were coming out of a recession. You usually come out of recessions at a pretty good annualized growth clip for a while, 9% range or something. We're not even close to there. And a decent economy, your consumer confidence number should be 80s, 90s. An overheated economy, bubble economy, you're looking at in the hundreds. This is better than terrible. It's not great.
James?
You know, Chris, I'm going to mix it up a little bit and say I noticed that copper is back up past its April highs.
Wow, copper?
Yeah, copper, Chris. And on a weak dollar and also Asian demand, Asian stocks are riding very high too. But let's focus on the weak dollar, because I would not be surprised to see emerging markets be the ones that pull the world out of recession, not the U.S. after all.
So you're just looking to kick back as an American and just let,
and just let them
else
do the work. Yeah,
I would be totally surprised by that, since most of them depend on selling their stuff to the U.S.
Ron,
but anyway.
Good point.
Ron Gross, what was your headline this week?
So I'll grab the stock market performance data. So I hate looking at markets on weekly or even monthly basis, but since it was such a dramatic increase of 9% in September, I think it's important to put it into context and remember that that's coming off of an August where we were down 4 or 5%. And we're actually up less than 4% for the entire year.
Shh.
And here we are, Seth, going into the fourth quarter.
Why do you hate freedom?
So let's put it in context. September was good, yep, but economy's weak, unemployment's high, consumer confidence is low, and we're only up 3 or 4% for the year. So, you know, let's calm down a bit.
I know it's a little early to start thinking about holiday spending and the retail numbers as we head into the fourth quarter, but is that something that you're starting to look at as an investor in the services you run? Are there numbers that you're looking for certain retailers or the retail sector overall to hit? Or is that just too far away at this point?
It's far away. The retail stocks have actually been doing pretty good, both stock-wise and in terms of their revenues. So regardless of any confidence surveys one way or another, people are still spending money. You know, but it's a tough thing. I mean, you don't know what happens until it's too late.
It's impossible to predict that stuff. So the guys in this room, I'll speak for all of them, since they can't reach me with their fists from where they're sitting. You look at the stock price more than you try to really accurately predict what the future is going to look like. Better to be sort of vaguely right than precisely wrong.
Yeah, and I'll say that when I look at individual companies, as long as we have 10% unemployment, I'm being pretty conservative with any kind of growth rate estimates, at least in the near or midterm, and that'll protect us on our downside if things continue to be weak.
AIG and Uncle Sam have agreed to a plan to pay back taxpayers for that $182 billion bailout. The agreement was reached on Wednesday after AIG's board met with government officials. James Early, I think I speak for everyone when I say, when do I get my check? How's this going to work?
Where's my $182 billion?
Exactly, yeah. Well, hell is frozen over and pigs are flying, Chris. I mean, I would not have expected the government to actually look like a smart investor, but it does. Let me clarify one thing, though. AIG does not make nearly enough money to actually pay this 180-something billion back in the normal sense of you paying something back. They're chopping off arms and legs and selling them and then giving additional ownership to the government, which now owns 92.1% of AIG. So it's like somebody who's deeply in debt buzzing his hair off and selling it to the wig shop to make a few bucks. I mean, maybe it's better than that because AIG does have a legitimate business. But
it was just swamped by all those illegitimate businesses that they had.
But it was, yes. So it is still good. I mean, and the government had very good timing here.
Well, here's the thing that maybe I'm just not that smart. It seems to me that the share price of AIG or any predicted share price upon which these, hey, the government might actually make money on this thesis rests is also based on, I mean, that share price is based on the fact that the government will not let AIG fail right now. So if you're extricating the government, you're getting rid of that guarantee, what are those shares really worth? I think the only reason they trade anywhere near where they trade now is because everybody knows that the thing can't lose any more money because the government's on the hook. Take that away, what are they worth?
Who's the America hater now?
Yeah.
Huh?
You're listening to Motley Fool Money. We're going through some of the big news stories of the week. Despite having record sales for the last fiscal year, Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer received only half the bonus he was eligible for. According to filings with the SEC, Ballmer took a hit from Microsoft's slow response to Apple's iPad and for the unsuccessful launch of the Kin phone. Ron Gross, you follow Microsoft pretty closely. What did you think of this decision?
I kind of like this, actually. In a full disclosure, we own Microsoft in the service I run, Million Dollar Portfolio, here at The Motley Fool. I kind of like seeing compensation committees step up and say, you know, we're going to pull back the reins here on the bonus. We didn't have a stellar year, 2 years, 3 years. We've had a lot of missteps, and you're not really eligible for the full amount of what's a pretty spectacular bonus in regular people terms. Let's not be too sad for Mr. Ballmer, since he did receive $670,000 or so. He'll be just fine.
He'd have been fine if they had given him nothing because he's worth $40 billion over the Microsoft stock, I think.
I think we were talking on last week's show about the Forbes annual list of the wealthiest Americans. He's 16th on that list.
So nobody's, no violin playing for him.
No, but I like because there's accountability at Microsoft, actually, and that's a good thing. We don't see that at a lot of companies. I can think of some smaller companies that grossly overpay their executives, even when their executives completely whiff on the growth plans. They give them a mulligan.
James?
Let me give you smiley faces a reality check here. So half of
how
the bonus
dare you.
For Steve Ballmer is $670,000, as discussed.
Yeah.
My number is maybe a low number for Steve Ballmer's net worth, which is $15 billion. This means the percentage of his net worth affected is 0.0045%.
We just said it wasn't that much.
If we take the median baby boomer's net worth, which is approximately $125,000, which is almost a story into itself, but just work with that number. For comparison, this would be the average baby boomer having his or her bonus reduced by $5.62.
There you go.
Stay tuned for more math wizardry with Professor James Early. Coming up, CEOs think shareholders like you have too many rights and they're not going to take it anymore. We'll explain why right after this. Stick around. You're listening to Motley Fool Money.
Money, money, money.
Welcome back to Motley Fool Money. Chris Hill here in the studio with Seth Jason, James Early, and Ron Gross as we dig into some of the companies making headlines this week. The iPhone 4 was released in China earlier this week, and just like in America, the lines were massive, with some reports indicating more than 1,000 customers waiting outside shops. James Early, you're an Apple enthusiast. Was this expected?
It was expected, actually. I'm gonna say that because Apple's shtick is not just making great products. It's making great products sexy and making them must-haves. And the Chinese market is big on must-haves. You know, something with almost like a cult following that demands sort of complete obedience. I mean, that's what we have in the U.S. with Apple. And so I think Apple is going to do very well in China.
Do you think at some level Apple is in danger of being a victim of its own success? If they get to the point where it's like, well, yeah, we were expecting there to be, you know, riots, as in fact there were some reports of riots, you know, people rioting to get iPhone 4. At some point, is that going to backfire for Apple?
That's interesting. I mean, I think as long as they make good products, you know, they'll get through it. But if they start depending on that cheekiness, absolutely.
On Wednesday, the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable, the lobbying groups representing many of America's biggest companies, sued the SEC to overturn a rule that ends management's exclusive lock on nominating corporate directors. Ron Gross, why are you and millions of individual investors picking on these poor CEOs?
Okay, so, Chris, as a former hedge fund manager who was actually an activist investor in a former life, and I used to run proxy contests against companies in order to put candidates on the board, nominees on the board of directors. I'm typically in favor of anything that puts power back in the hands of shareholders mm-hmm. and away from management and entrenched boards. I think we have to be a little careful of unintended consequences here. There is some concern that large pension funds, unions, will try to use their ownership of companies to push forth their agenda and pack boards. I'm not too concerned about that. I think the market in the regards of voting is relatively efficient. Shareholders will vote their conscience.
And anything that
puts the power into the hands of the real owners of the company, the shareholders, I think is good.
And Ron, just to be specific about the rule here, I think it only applies to this proxy access nomination thing only applies to large shareholders who held their shares for at least 3 years.
Correct,
right?
So, which is why something like a pension fund would
exactly.
be eligible.
It eliminates most regular investors.
Now, back in the old days, you can still nominate someone for a board.
Most if they don't like them, they'll crush you like an ant.
Right, correct.
It's like running in yourself for president or something.
So this makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah. In general, you also want to be very skeptical of the Chamber of Commerce nationally. Not long ago, they were beating the drum on this whole naked shorting thing, and I think...
And they don't believe in global warming either.
Yeah, it really, really, really foolishly. They, you can ignore them safely.
On Thursday, Fisher-Price announced a voluntary recall of more than 10 million children's products sold in the U.S. Included in the recall were 14 models of tricycles and nearly 1 million high chairs. Fisher-Price is owned by Mattel. So, Jason, you are a father. You are also a cycling enthusiast. Does your little girl have one of these trikes?
She doesn't, and I'm looking at one of these Dora trikes right now. There's this tiny little rounded plastic key that is supposedly responsible for much injury. Good for Fisher-Price. Good for Mattel. This is a penny on $1.70 worth of earnings or something. It doesn't mean anything to them financially, and it will get people off their back and maybe save a very few kids from getting a bump. But honestly, my house, anybody's house, has hundreds and hundreds of better ways for children to get hurt.
Better ways. I like that.
Much more likely ways. We had 36 injuries in how many million toys? That's nothing.
James?
Yeah, next time my child rides death trap trike over to his hazardous high chair, I'll think of Fisher-Price. No, I have to agree with Seth on this, actually. I'm sure there's just statistically a number of injuries on Fisher-Price things anyway, but, you know, good for Fisher-Price for being proactive here, unlike Johnson & Johnson, which had 40 different kids' medicines that were contaminated with metal shavings and bacteria and crud like that, and they didn't issue a recall. Instead, they sent the sneaky people out to try to buy it on the sly. So, I mean, it's probably a partially a wasteful expenditure on Fisher-Price's part, but hey, maybe it's a good move.
We got to give him a thumbs up, though. I mean, it's just seriously, as yeah, you do, in you being don't. A good wonder, corporate citizen.
Yeah, oh, yes. I wonder if we yeah. also just, I mean, Americans are such sissies about everything. Everybody wants to think they're the big, tough American and I'm self-sufficient. And really, we are just sissies. If we can blame somebody else for a problem, my kid the other day tripped over my foot and hit her eye and cheek on the edge of a door. I mean, should I
I'm going to be calling social services.
I don't know what you
should
off.
You know, should I complain to the door makers that the edges of their doors are too sharp? She had this bruise line going up and down her face. No, it was my fault. I shouldn't.
Although
let's grow up, people.
Although I did hear that your lovely bride is filing paperwork to have you recalled.
Yeah. I'm still offended that you called me a sissy. I drive an SUV.
You're listening to Motley Fool Money. We're going through some of the newsmakers this week. On Wednesday, shares of Green Mountain Coffee Roasters fell 16% after it was revealed the SEC has made an official inquiry into the company's revenue recognition practices. Ironically, Wednesday was also National Coffee Day. Ron Gross, what is going on here?
The irony just writes itself, doesn't it?
It does.
So I can't speak to whether the revenue recognition problems are true problems because we just don't have enough information yet. The analyst reports I'm reading seem to indicate that people are not that concerned.
It's also really boring.
Yeah, it's pretty boring. I was never a lover of Green Mountain just on its own merits in the sense that, you know, we see profitability on a per cup of coffee basis really not growing, the market affording it a multiple that was really too high in my opinion.
Don't they have that little patent expiring thing
they
coming
have an It is a fad issue. There's a patent expiring issue.
They just
issue.
Spent a bunch of money on buying the Folgers of Canada. That looks desperate
I will
me.
Say I use the Keurig machine pretty much every day. Big fan of the product, just never a big fan of the stock.
James?
You know, just technically speaking, the issue would seem to be, I think they sell most of their product to a distributor who then sells it to, you know, the
one
user.
Distributor,
so
correct.
The question is, I think, was there ever booked, they would normally book it when the distributor then sells the product versus when they first sell to the distributor, which is revenue recognition is a nasty thing if you're actually doing it, if you're fudging the revenue recognition. But could it be that the SEC is mad that they missed Madoff, so now they're going after Green Mountain Coffee, which is
I don't think so.
A Vermont-based business?
Well, I mean,
really? Vermont is like the Sweden of America. I mean, it's just wholesome in every which way.
You're in there communists? Are you calling Vermont a communist
I feel healthy
state?
When I'm in Vermont. I'll say that.
Let's pull back from Green Mountain for just a second. Just as an investor, when you, regardless of what the company is, when there's an SEC inquiry into something like revenue recognition, is this an automatic red flag? Is this a where there's smoke, there's fire thing?
It depends. You know, the SEC is very easily pushed around. There's political motivation sometimes can cause the SEC to start an investigation. I don't think there's any of that here. So it's really hard to say. I mean, if this is a symptom of some greater legality.
I like that.
Then that was
slimy, but
it's copyrighted though.
Yeah. Then you'd have to worry, but you'll never know. You'll never know in time, and that's why people sold it off.
And finally, it's time for This Week in Swedish Retail. IKEA, the home furnishing giant, said its profits rose 11% over the past year, and fashion retailer H&M posted a 22% rise in quarterly profits. Analysts, however, were expecting more, and the stock fell on the news. Seth Jason, you're one of our top retail guys, and you look vaguely Swedish to me.
And
so.
I love to go to Sweden.
So what did you make of the news?
Vaguely Swedish.
You know, IKEA is a really strange story. It's the first time they've disclosed this information publicly. There was a big Economist article on IKEA. It's actually impossible to fully figure out the ownership structure. It's a bunch of small companies, and then it's a nonprofit for the further of design. So I actually wouldn't trust any number that IKEA reported. The only reason they're doing this, I think, is to try and deflect criticism that here's this multi-billion dollar operation that is tax advantaged and not actually telling you where the money goes, yet it seems to have this sort of hip green feeling to it. If we can turn to H&M, I thought those results were interesting. A fairly nice profit increase, didn't please analysts. And the reason is a reason you're going to see a lot coming up, which is that margins are down. Most retailers out there right now are cutting the prices. And so what they're trying to do, they're cutting the prices on the product. So they're losing gross margin on the product, hoping that they can make up margin moving more people into the stores. That doesn't always work out.
James Early, yeah, final word?
Sure, and wouldn't it be like these are sort of counter cyclical indicators too? I mean, these are some of the cheapest retailers you can get. I mean, you can buy a whole stack of clothes and put it in an IKEA wardrobe for $200
an H&M wardrobe, yeah.
3 months,
yeah, but exactly. Yeah, for $200 you can also fill a house with all of those wobbly CD cases with most of the screws in the box.
And what about the leftover screws that I have because I can never put them together?
And all of those little wrenches.
All right, coming up, the guys will be back later in the show to talk about the stocks on their radar. But up next, Academy Award nominated filmmaker Charles Ferguson talks about Inside Job, his new documentary about the financial crisis.
Just bring me lots and lots of money.
Stick around. You're listening to Motley Fool Money. Welcome back to Motley Fool Money. I'm Chris Hill. So was the financial crisis an inside job? Charles Ferguson is a filmmaker whose first documentary earned him an Academy Award nomination. His second documentary is Inside Job, a look at the financial crisis.
Share prices continued to tumble.
Lehman Brothers was forced to declare itself bankrupt.
The largest single point drop.
The regulators, they had the power to do every case that I made when I was state attorney general. They just didn't want to.
Charles Ferguson joins me now. So let me start with something, I guess, kind of basic. What attracted you to this story?
Well, there are several answers to that question, actually. There's a serious answer, and then there's a kind of black humorish answer, which is all too serious as well, actually.
We're fans of black humor at The Motley Fool, so.
Okay, well, all right, so first the sober and serious answer is that this is obviously a gigantic event which has affected the lives and indeed destroyed the lives of tens of millions of people who've lost their jobs, their houses, their life savings as a consequence of this catastrophe. And so explaining it to the world would seem to be a useful and important thing to do. There's the black humor answer is I'm a great fan of heist movies. And that's definitely a genre in which I would like to work. I love the Thomas Crown Affair and Inside Man and, you know, all those kinds of movies. And here we have a heist, and I made a heist movie. It's a quite spectacular heist, and it was an inside job, hence the name of the film and the title of the film. And it's one in which the robbers spent about $5-10 billion paying off the police before they committed the robbery, and also continue to pay off the police after the robbery, and they've gotten away with it. And the amount that they heisted is certainly in the tens of billions of dollars. It might even be in the hundreds of billions of dollars. It's without any question the largest financial bubble and the largest fraud in economic history.
You interview over 40 people in this film. One of them is Noriel Roubini, the economics professor at NYU. And one of the things you ask him is, why do you think there isn't a more systematic investigation being undertaken? And he says very directly, because then you'd find the culprits. I mean, that seems to point towards the government protecting the wrongdoers. Do you think that's the case?
Yes, I do. There's no question in my mind that that's going on, and while I'm not entirely certain what the calculation is in President Obama's head that has led him to condone such behavior, there's no question that that's what's going on. There's not been a single criminal prosecution, which is quite extraordinary and very different from previous economic crises, financial crises, and after the savings and loan scandals of the late 1980s, there were several thousand criminal prosecutions, and hundreds of financial executives, perhaps thousands, certainly hundreds, went to prison. And even after the dot-com bubble and the collapse of Enron and WorldCom, roughly a decade ago, a smaller number, but still substantial number of people, certainly dozens, went to prison. This time, not a single person has even been arrested, and there's also been no special prosecutor appointed. There's been no equivalent of the PCORA Commission or other, you know, really serious investigative commissions. there have only been a handful even of civil cases filed by the government. It's really extraordinarily shocking.
How much of this problem is about the people involved? And in particular, I'm talking about executives at the major financial firms like Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Bank of America. And how much of it is the system?
That's a good question. It's both. By this point, I think it's both. But the system was in very significant measure created by a relatively small number of people, meaning hundreds, perhaps a few thousand, people in the financial services industry, running the financial services industry, who made a very concerted effort to lobby the government, to change laws, to weaken regulation, to weaken law enforcement, and by paying off the economics discipline, to spread the idea that deregulated and unregulated finance was okay and was even a good idea.
Before your filmmaking career, you were a consultant at some of the biggest tech companies in America, companies like Apple, Xerox, Texas Instruments. I'm certainly not suggesting that this type of thing is only contained on Wall Street, because certainly you could be a crooked leader no matter what business you're in. You could run a crooked lemonade stand. But it just seems like the incentive for wrongdoing is so much greater at a Wall Street firm than if you're running a major retail business or a major tech company. Do you think that that's the case?
Yes, it is. It's absolutely the case. And one sees that in many different ways in the behavior of the two industries. In the first place, the technology sector is, for the most part, quite competitive. And while sometimes a firm such as Microsoft, say, or earlier IBM, has a strong or even dominant position, that usually isn't the case, and even when it is the case, it doesn't last forever. It's a very competitive industry, and so if you try and defraud somebody, they simply will stop buying your product. They'll buy other people's products, and there's a ferocious contest for technological progress and providing value to customers. That's one thing that you see. Another thing that you see that's a remarkable difference between technology and financial services is pay structures and compensation structures and incentives. When I started my software company, I started and ran a software company in the mid-1990s, successfully so. It was a venture-funded startup. The venture capitalists who invested in me sat me down and told me extremely directly, your salary is going to be $100,000 a year. It's never going to go up. Your stock is going to vest over 5 years. You cannot sell any of it. So go make your stock worth something. And also no outside activities. And needless to say, the cash in the company was not spent on lobbying or entertaining. It was spent on developing products. And if I had gone to them with the typical compensation package of a trader or Wall Street executive these days and said, you know, I have this great idea, please pay me a guaranteed cash bonus of $5 million next year, would have been a very short meeting.
You're listening to Motley Fool Money. We're talking with Charles Ferguson, the writer-director of the new documentary Inside Job. All right, Charles, time to wrap up with a round of buy, sell, or hold. Let's start with this company. It's being mentioned as a big threat to Google. Buy, sell, or hold, the future of Facebook.
Ah, I would say hold.
Why is that?
Well, clearly a very successful company, but I tend to suspect that it's going to be difficult for them to move out of their very big, very successful niche. And the people who run Google and other companies with which they might find themselves competing have a very, very deep technical and engineering culture, which I think is quite different from the way Facebook runs.
You did some consulting for Apple in the early 90s, so I think this qualifies you to weigh in on this one. Buy, sell, or hold the future of the iPhone?
Oh, I would say buy. Yeah. I'm an enthusiast. In you know, fair disclosure, I'm also a shareholder. I own a fair amount of Apple stock. I think
that's why you're doing this interview, right? It's not to promote your movie. It's just to pump the Apple stock.
That's it. I'm a believer that Apple has a very, very good run in front of it. I would say for at least 5 years, Apple is going to be very successful for two reasons. One is that its products are fantastic, and the second is that those products are undercutting the entrenched dominant positions of the rest of the technology sector, both the consumer technology sector, like BlackBerry's, for example, and also the likes of Microsoft and Hewlett-Packard, you know, the Wintel personal computer industry. I think Apple is superbly positioned for at least another 5 years.
We were talking earlier about technology company CEOs, and this one is locked in a tight race. The likelihood that former eBay CEO Meg Whitman will be elected governor of California. Buy, sell, or hold?
Oh, well, everything's for sale these days, and I think that she's already spent $120 million of her own money, so I would say that her odds are pretty good, although I can't say that I think it's the best way to run a democracy.
Fair enough. Finally, we've seen this in everything from Avatar to Toy Story 3. It's all the rage these days. Buy, sell, or hold, inside job in 3D.
Ooh, I think we'd make a great 3D movie.
You think so?
I think it would be fantastic. Yes, those aerial shots of Manhattan. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think that there's at least a half hour of our movie that looks really, really cool, and I would love to see people wearing 3D glasses.
All right, I think Motley Fool gets a special thanks in the credits if that happens.
Absolutely.
All right, the film is Inside Job. Writer-director Charles Ferguson, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
I bought a little house in 2006. The man at the bank said the mortgage ain't fixed. But don't worry, son, it's your dream come true. Well, Lord, he didn't warn me about them subprime blues. I said, what about my credit score? He said, it's fine, as he showed me the door. Then he grabbed.
Coming up, an inside look at the stocks on our radar. Plus, which is bigger? Don't go away. This is Motley Fool Money.
Things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
As always, people on the program may have interest in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy or sell stocks based solely on what you hear. I'm Chris Hill, and back in the studio with me, our trio of senior analysts, Seth Jason, James Early, and Ron Gross. Time to play Which is Bigger? When here to help us out is our man Steve Broido. Steve Broido, what's our first question?
Okay, gentlemen, which is bigger, the total number of drink combinations at Starbucks, according to a 2008 Starbucks ad, or the price in dollars of Berkshire Hathaway A shares?
Wow. Okay, wow. How many drinks?
I know the answer to this. It's definitely Berkshire. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Roughly.
Well,
how many
drinks in combination?
$124,000.
Yeah, and
there's no way.
There's maybe 30 drinks.
There's 20 drinks and 30, I mean...
Carry the two.
Or something.
I need a calculator.
No, according to an ad, so they were probably BSing. Oh, they could have put an exponent.
No.
Ads would never.
You
BS.
Could get James Early math professor.
So I mean, think about it. How many? You know,
we're going off menu here. Okay.
I'm going Starbucks drink combinations.
Actually, yeah.
He's probably right because
it's
the counterintuitive.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Let's go with that.
Steve.
Well, the correct answer: Berkshire is bigger.
See, that's what I said.
Berkshire A shares trade around $124,000. Strong work, Ron. Starbucks claims to have over 87,000 different drink combinations.
Which is
ridiculous.
That's pretty
close, though.
Which is how many I have to wait through every time I go to a Starbucks for some weirdo who's got to have 8,000 custom things in their coffee.
You're a bitter, bitter man, Seth Jason.
Just get a cup of coffee and get out of my way.
Steve, what's next?
All right, number two, which is bigger, the weight of Amazon's new Kindle 3 in pounds or the total number of Chipotle restaurants currently serving breakfast?
Wow.
It's the way to the Kindle, because it's yeah. one Chipotle restaurant, I think. And no, wait, in pounds.
In pounds.
So
in
what's
pounds,
it weigh?
It's under a pound. So it's the Chipotle serving
breakfast. I just bought a new Kindle. Yeah. Full disclosure, just bought it.
Yeah,
for,
it's under a pound, and there's one. There's at least one Chipotle serving breakfast.
Four Big Apples. Is it lighter than that?
It's under a pound.
Under a pound.
It's
okay.
The Chipotle's, dudes.
All right. Steve, what do we got?
Well, the number of Chipotle restaurants serving breakfast is the correct answer. The Kindle 3 weighs 8.5 ounces, which is around half a pound. Only one Chipotle currently
nice.
Serves
Strong.
Breakfast.
Yeah.
Where is that one, by the way?
Dulles Airport location.
Airport. Yeah, here.
In Virginia.
Yeah.
And airports there are required. I'm sorry, restaurants at airports. Let me try this again as I'm losing my mind. airports in Dulles are required to serve breakfast.
Or restaurants.
Restaurants at Dulles Airport.
Can we just roll it like that? It's a lot
funnier. I like that.
It definitely is more humorous.
Oh, take that, all you Steve Broido fans. He messes up too.
He does indeed.
All right, Steve, what's our last question?
Final one, which is bigger, Amazon's market cap in dollars or the combined market cap of eBay, Priceline, Netflix, and Yahoo in dollars?
Good question.
Ooh, that
I'm going with the combination.
I'll go with Amazon.
I don't know. You know, Netflix really bumps up that combo. What do you think, Seth?
No, I think it's the combo.
I do too.
Well, eBay, I guess, is pretty big.
As an Amazon shareholder, I'm going to stick by my man Jeff Bezos, and I'm going to go with Amazon.
Well, everyone seems correct except for Chris. The combined market caps are indeed bigger, but not by much. Amazon has a market cap of around $68 billion. Yahoo is around $19 billion. eBay is around $32 billion. Priceline is around $16 billion. Netflix is around $8 billion. So the combined market caps of Yahoo, eBay, Priceline, and Netflix are $75 billion.
eBay's going the way of the dodo.
All right. Thank you, Steve Broido. All right, guys. Time to talk about the stocks that are on our radar. And Ron Gross, we will start with you.
All right, Chris. I'm going to hit you with one that we also own in the million-dollar portfolio, known as a mini Berkshire Hathaway Markel Corporation, specialty insurance company. Really fantastic underwriters, actually make money on the insurance side of the business, not just the investment side of the business, which is typical of insurance companies nowadays. Tom Gaynor, their investment chief, has amassed a great track record, a great steward of their capital, and has generated some great investment returns. And I think we've got some multiple expansion on the horizon. They're going to continue to grow book value. I like it short term, long term. I think it's a good one.
And for someone like me who knows pretty much nothing about insurance, when you say specialty insurance, they're just insuring sports teams? What are they doing?
Take everything from ballet studios to dude ranches, anything that is, you know.
You had me at dude ranch.
That's quite a range.
Yeah, wow. It's really niche businesses, which unlike, let's say, car insurance, which is basically a commodity business that competes on price, these niche things are not so much commodity-based. There's service aspects to them.
You need special spreadsheets for those.
Makes it much more interesting than your typical life insurance company or
car insurance
company.
And final question, do they have any talking rodents as their mascot?
No, they're pretty low-profile guys. Okay. No rodents.
I like them already. All right, James Early.
Chris, when I hear about the metal shavings in children's Tylenol, when I hear about the bacteria and fungus or dirt or whatever, I get excited. Not because
disgusting.
Not because it's a bad. I mean, I get excited because there could be a buying opportunity. In this case, these things are bad, but they're not nearly bad enough to rock Johnson & Johnson's boat. This is a very big, stable company. Johnson & Johnson is one of my income investor stocks. It pays a 3.5% yield and has paid a dividend every year since 1944. So I say, you know, this is bad news and it's unfortunate, but buying on the bad news could be a smart move right now.
And the ticker?
JNJ.
Seth Jason.
I'm going to continue with the callous disregard for our nation's most innocent and say you should look at Mattel. Now, Mattel hasn't really been beat up too much because of this. With the Fisher Price recall. So I was looking at the numbers, and I said, wow, a 9.3% free cash flow yield, a 3.2% dividend yield. They sell a lot of toys that don't maim children. Uh-huh. I have a ton of them at my house. And guess what? These toys wear out, and they keep finding new markets. It's trading near the back end, the low end of its historical sort of P/E ratio. I think you could do a lot worse, especially right now when you can't get anything on money in a savings account. So Mattel, M-A-T.
And one of their big brands is Barbie. Does your little girl have some Barbies?
I'm going to have trouble with that whole Barbie and princess thing. I'm hoping I can have a girl who likes rock tumblers and race cars.
Good luck with that. Let me know how it works out.
Barbie's got a little trampy, too.
I know, really.
It's not like it used to be.
All right, we'll wrap up with Barbie being a little trampy. Seth Jason, James Early, Ron Gross, guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thanks also to our special guest this week, filmmaker Charles Ferguson. His new documentary, Inside Job, opens in New York City and Los Angeles later this month. If you missed any part of the show, you can find it at our website, motleyfoolmoney.com. Our engineer is Steve Broido. Our producer is Matt Greer. I'm Chris Hill. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.